Well, you know, sometimes when fighter pilots get together, the stories start flying, literally flying, and you'll need some air traffic control. Tonight's final program features some of the best-known fighter pilots from World War II, and we can think of no better person to maintain order than former Good Morning America host David Hartman. He's a veteran of more than 12,000 interviews, and he'll add to that total tonight. He's an award-winning journalist and a former officer with Strategic Air Command. Here's something you might not have known. David turned down an offer to play professional baseball in high school so he could go to Duke University, where he earned a degree in economics. So baseball's loss is our gain.
Thank you. Hi. It's my family. Hi, good evening, everybody. We're all celebrating freedom tonight. Back in the 1930s into the 1940s, both Japan and Germany tried to deny the opportunity of many people in the world to be free. And of course, the result was World War II. World War II killed more people, it damaged more property, it cost more money, it affected more of humanity and caused more far-reaching change than any war in history. And as all of you know too well, aviation played a huge part in the war. Hundreds of thousands, literally, of airplanes, and thousands, tens of thousands of pilots and air crews and ground crews made that possible. Five of those aviators, all very significant ones, are with us tonight. They happen to be all fighter pilots. Four of them fought for the United States. One of them fought for Germany. So here they are in no particular order, except I'm going to start with the one who wound up with the highest rank. And that would be Lieutenant General Gunther Rall. Gunther Rall. We know he didn't chicken out. Gunther, where are you, my man? Yeah, here he is. Come on up. As a German Luftwaffe pilot, Gunther flew 621 sorties, 621, on both fronts, on the Western Front against the United States, Britain, etc., and on the Eastern Front against Russia. He was seriously injured more than once, came back to fly. He test flew many captured Allied aircraft, P-38, P-47, P-51, the Spitfire, and he did that without manuals, and then devised tactics for their fighter pilots to try to defeat our fighter pilots. He was the first to fly the German Messerschmitt 262 jet. After the war, he worked with NATO to help develop the NATO Air Force and the West German Air Force, and later became its what we would call chief of staff of the German Air Force. He was the first German to fly the F-104 Starfighter and had that, with his advising, modified to be a NATO aircraft. In the history of warfare, he is the third ranking ace and currently the highest ranking ace who is living, with 275 air victories, Lieutenant General Gunther Rall. Bud Anderson was a triple ace in World War II, flew 116 missions in the P-51 Mustang, had 16 and a quarter air victories. He was one of, they were called the Yoxford boys. That was the 357th Fighter Group at Leiston in England. Yoxford was a little town nearby. After the war, he became a test pilot at Wright Field, then at Edwards Air Force Base. He flew 90 types of aircraft. He was chief of test ops at Edwards, then deputy director of flight test for the Flight Test Center. In Vietnam War in 1970, he was the commandant, the commander of a F-105 wing in Thailand, and at the age of 48, he flew 25 missions over Vietnam. He retired after 30 years, a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, has 6,700 hours. He continues to fly, these days, Jack Roush's P-51 Mustang, which is painted up, as you all know, in his old paint scheme of Old Crow. This is Bud Anderson. Don Lopez is here. He is deputy director of the National Air and Space Museum, Smithsonian in Washington, with Mike Collins and a very small team. The team planned and constructed and opened the Air and Space Museum in 1976. He's written three wonderful books on aviation and space. In World War II, he flew P-40s and Mustangs in the 23rd Fighter Group, which succeeded the Flying Tigers. He is an ace. He had four victories in the P-40, one victory in the P-51 Mustang. He then became a test pilot at Edwards and flew jets in Korea. This is Don Lopez. Bob Hoover. Do we have to introduce Bob Hoover? Come on, Bob. But I'm going to introduce him anyway. He soloed at 16. In the Army Air Corps, he had taught himself acrobatics so fabulously that he wound up teaching all his Army instructors how to fly aerobatics. He flew 58 missions in Spitfires and P-38s. In 1944, he was shot down. He was a prisoner of war for 15 months. He escaped and then became a test pilot after the war at Wright Field. As you all know, was backup pilot to Chuck Yeager in the Bell XS-1 program and did not get to fly the Bell XS-1, but he did fly Chase. And that famous picture of Chuck going supersonic on the 14th of October, 1947, Bob took the picture. As a civilian test pilot for North American Rockwell for many years, but you all know that for decades he is recognized as maybe the finest demonstration pilot ever in all kinds of airplanes, but his Shrike Commander, once you've seen him fly that, you've seen it all. This is Bob Hoover. And Shorty Rankin. Shorty. Shorty was a P-47 driver in the famous Zemke group, the 56th Fighter Group. That group, by the way, shot down more enemy airplanes than any other 8th Air Force fighter group. Shorty was a double ace. He was the first P-47 pilot to be ace in a day, when he shot down five BF-109s in one sortie. This is Shorty Rankin. Gunther, start us off. Tell us about the BF-109. How significant was that airplane in your career, and what were its qualities, both the good qualities and the bad qualities of the BF-109?
When I was trained as a fighter pilot, I was not trained on the 109, but before I came to combat wing, I got two takeoffs with a 109. This was a 109D. And I came to the combat wing, wing 52, and there we had the 109E. And I flew throughout the war in combat, and my units were equipped only with 109s, the different types, 109E, F, G, and H. The 109 had some characteristics compared with other ones, were not the best ones. You know, we were convinced the 109 is a good airplane, no doubt. But later on, I had the chance when I out of combat because I was injured, and I was 3 months out of combat, I got the chance to fly also the American and British fighters, the P-51, the P-47, P-38, the Spitfire, and so I could compare the different criteria. And I just want to tell you what I figured out. You know, the 109 was an aircraft. It had slots, wings which increase the lift at low speed. But in a combat, when you have to rough turns, just by gravity, the outer slot could come out, and you could in a stall, which was certainly negative. But it seldom happened. It was not a normal event. I just tell the critical things. Then the 109 had a very tight cockpit. And I'm wondering, when I see a 109 today, I was wondering how my squadron commanders at the height of 1 meter 85 centimeters could fight a war for 5 years sitting in that cockpit just looking between the knees. Because between the legs, we had the cannon. The visibility to the back was not as good as, for instance, in some other aircraft. I come to I compare them with other ones. Then, a very serious problem was the starting system. You know, I had the pleasure to be 3.5 years in Russia in the wintertime, minus 30 degrees centigrade, snow from horizon to horizon. And the starting system were eclipse starting. This means the mechanic has to stay on the right wing and oing, 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 turn up the engine and that out. We did it for hours and hours and we never got it running. Finally, we made open fire underneath. When I came much later, I had a chance to fly the P-51. When I climbed in the cockpit and I was enthusiastic, feeling electrical starting system. Brrch, here we go. It's a big benefit. Then, the undercarriage. The undercarriage, the 109, was high and tight. But the positive things, 109 was at speed, good, was flexible, was maneuverable, and had a very good weapon set. We had, I had 20 millimeters through the propeller and 15 millimeters on top of the engine. I also had under the wing 15 millimeters, but in some dogfights, flying a very rough turn, the chain broke who was supporting that gun. And I got a complete weapon jam. So I take those off and said, a pilot has to aim exactly and I can do it with three weapons, one through the propeller and two right on top of the engine. I flew, as I mentioned, the 109 over France, where I got my first victory, over England in the Battle of Britain against the Spitfires, which was very critical, and the Mustang. Then later on against the Russians. Against the Russians, we had absolutely the superior aircraft because the Russians at the beginning of their war had obsolete aircraft. This was the Rata E-16, still from the Spanish Civil War, or the E-153. So we were superior besides the fact that the tactics of the Russians was also inferior, and it caused tremendous losses at the beginning of the war against Russia. But The Russians learned their lesson pretty soon and very quick. They came to other airplanes, the MiG series, the Lux series, which was good. They changed the tactics and flew up the same tactic as we with the four-ship formation. So from there on, we had absolutely equivalent opponents on the other side. For instance, types like Luck 5, and remember, I chased the Luck 5 and never could get him. On the other hand, the Russians also had certainly Anglo-American airplanes in the south, and so there was a quite equivalent situation.
Gunther, let me interrupt you. Talking about equivalent airplanes and competition, and talking about the airplanes you flew, Shorty, the P-47, how did the P-47 fly, and how was it competitively with the 109?
He told you, we kicked his ass. No, the P-47, and Gunther, he'll tell you.
I gotta tell him what you said.
You tell him, he don't care.
Yeah, or his thumb. No. Yeah, you did get his thumb. Yeah.
No.
Now, go ahead, Shorty.
He asked me yesterday, what did you do with my thumb? I said, I never had it. You left it in Germany. No, it actually, Gunther know this, because I heard him tell people since I've been here, nothing could dive with the P-47. Not only could it dive faster, but it was structurally sound. And one of the victories I got on May the 12th was straight down from 25 to 30,000 feet, and we knew that it could not pull out if it was going vertically at 5,000 feet. Well, watching this airplane, 109 in front of me, wings started to flutter and shake, and it got my attention, and I looked to see what I was doing, and I was indicating 575. It got my attention big time. I grabbed that stick with both hands and started pulling back, and fortunately, it saved my life. I pulled out just above the tree level, but that 109 splashed in.
Tell us what happened on May 12th, 1944.
Well, I just told you the first victory I got on May the 12th of 44. After I pulled off of that one, I got up to 8,000 feet, and I looked down, there's a 109 heading east, and I immediately put a bounce on that one. I got him at 2,000 feet and hit him real hard. It did a two-violent snap roll and pitched in and went straight into the ground. And so right after that, like any fighter pilot, you want to get altitude. I started climbing. And while I'm climbing up, I got a call from our valued leader, Hub Zemke. His call sign was Fairbanks Leader. He said, this is Fairbanks Leader. I'm 10 miles south of Koblenz. I'm over the whole Luftwaffe. That's quite a statement. It got my attention. So I knew where Koblenz was, and I had a wingman who was on his first mission. And so we started heading in that direction, and I got up to 10,000 feet, and I looked straight ahead, and at that level, the Germans used a prominent landmark to rendezvous fighters coming in from many fields. And I looked out and I saw this, I've never seen anything like it before or since, just airplanes going all over the place like a swarm of flies. And I thought, I better turn and go east. I didn't like the way to look, but anyway, that time I looked up and there's a lone P-47 above the German Luftwaffe, what he had called it. And I told him I had him in sight, I'm climbing up to meet you. So climbed up to his empty and he said, I'll go down when I get back. You can go down. When he started to move, I said, wait a minute, what about these right above us? And I looked above and there were about 25 or 30 passed right over. I felt like I could reach up and touch them. He said, oh, they're friendly. And I said, they're not. They got black crosses all over them. But they didn't pay any attention to us, thank God. They were heading for the bomber trail. I assumed that's where they were going.
What squadrons were these 109s?
They were German squadrons. That's all I can tell you. That's all I needed to know.
Well, we know that there's a pilot present who happened to be flying in that group.
I can tell you that part, which I got from Gunther. Gunther was flying top cover for, I think, two groups of Focke-Wulf 190s, which had heavier armor than the 109, They were going to hit the bombers. He was top cover for those two groups. They always had an airborne group commander, who would gather so many of these fighters down here and get them in formation and send them up to hit the bombers. That commander lost his radio. So they called this gallant young fighter pilot over here and said, Gunther, you go down and you assume command of these fighters down there, which he did. On his way down, he ran into my group commander, who at that time had two wingmen with him, and Gunther and his troops, they went ahead and shot both of those down. And Hub Zemke split us and went to the deck, and they thought they had him too. As I recall, Gunther, I think you told me there were seven of your 109s together when you zapped Zemke's group. So on his way down then, they thought they had Zemke, but they didn't. He had gone to the deck, but he turned around and climbed back for altitude, and that's where he was when I found him. In the meantime, four P-47s jumped on this young German, and they boxed him in and proceeded to shoot him down. One of those people was from my squadron. To this day, we do not know who that pilot was. I had handwritten combat reports of everybody that filed a victory report on that mission. I let Gunther assume when he was writing his first book. I went over it, and I don't know how many people. We could not figure out anybody there in our squadron that did that. So I didn't shoot the thumb off.
No, but one of your guys.
Yeah, that's all right. Hey, Gunther, you got two of our guys.
Huh?
You got two of our guys. That's part of the game, isn't it?
You know, this raises an important question. Buds, go to this, would you? And I want everybody to touch on this. What, as fighter pilots fighting against each other, what was your attitude toward the other fighter pilots in this kind of combat?
Can I answer
Shorty?
That first? I think this German would tell you the same thing. We didn't think about shooting or killing any pilots. We thought about knocking down an airplane. That was our attitude. That's the way we fought the war. Isn't that right, Gunther?
Yes, the fighter pilot is out for the aircraft and not for the pilot, for the men. And in our situation, in our pilot's pass, was one paragraph which forbid us to shoot at parachutes. This was not allowed and was against the law. So the aim was to get the aircraft down. This is the objective. If the pilot gets out, he's heavy, he can gun down the parachute, but not be shut down at the parachute from the enemy fighter.
Let's move to another part of the world. Don, how was it that American aviators were flying in Asia before the United States officially entered the war?
General Sinault was the Air Force captain and a real leader in tactics. But he was pushing for fighters all the time, where the rest of the Air Force leadership wanted bombers because they wanted to hit a separate Air Force eventually. And so they finally retired him for a hearing problem because they were tired of hearing him. And they he got offered the job as commander of the Chinese Air Force. The Chinese were being attacked regularly by the Japanese bombers, and they had nothing. Their fighters were very poor fighters and very poorly trained pilots. So he came over and straightened them out somewhat, but he really couldn't do the job he needed because he didn't have the pilots to do it. So President Roosevelt knew that the U.S. would be getting into war one of these days, and so he allowed 100 military, U.S. military pilots, Navy, Army, and Marine Corps, to resign their commissions and sign up as pilots with the American Volunteer Group, that became the famous Flying Tigers. And they got 100 P-40s from the British took them over to Burma. And actually, they actually trained in Burma, but they didn't start actual combat till December 21st of 1941, 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. But the Japanese came in to bomb Kunming, which is the big Chinese base over there, city over there, and the AVG attacked them and shot down about half of them. And they really never bombed freely after that. They really could protect the place very well. They were outstanding. They had an unbelievable record of about 299 victories, and they only lost eight in the air. They lost to accident and ground strafing, but they only lost eight in air combat. So that's an unbelievable record. But even more than that, I think, because 300 airplanes isn't much in the whole course of the war, but they were the first ones to stop the Japanese. The Japanese were running roughshod over everybody at that time. And they were the first ones, by using Chennault's tactics of not trying to turn with the Japanese because their airplanes were so maneuverable, but shooting at them, passing on, and coming back again. The British had tried to dogfight with them and lost a lot of Spitfires and Hurricanes because of that. But Chennault had worked out the tactics, and he was a great tactician.
Tell us about a couple, if you will, of the significant missions that were so amazingly effective of the Flying Tigers and also your 23rd Fighter Group.
Well, one mission that Tex Hill ran on Thanksgiving Day of 1943. Tex Hill was one of the AVG, one of the squadron commanders. And when they were disbanded on July 1942, the 23rd Group was formed right on the spot. And Guard's first pilot, Robert L. Scott, took it over. And Tex was one of the five AVG pilots that stayed and accepted commissions in the Army. He was a Navy trained pilot, but he became a major and took over one of the fighter squadron, the one I eventually got into, the 75th Fighter Squadron, which was by far the best squadron over there. And you don't have to believe me, ask anybody in the 75th. And he stayed over, he went home and took over the test flying at Eglin Air Force Base, was Army Airfield, and then came back and led the 23rd Group. And he formed a mission to bomb Formosa, attack Formosa with P-51s. The P-40 couldn't get there, didn't have the range. P-51s, P-38s, and B-25s. And they went over right on the deck, just a few feet off the water, and hit the Formosa. And nobody knew they were coming. They were all training pilots there, and he's all flying around, and they shot down a whole bunch of them and really, really did a tremendous job.
Bud Anderson, do you remember your very first air victory and how it happened and how you felt at the time?
I don't know whether I want to talk about that one or not.
How about your second?
Well, I'll talk about it.
Okay.
You talk me into it. You know, we haven't got a clue what his questions are when we're back there. Well, it's kind of a humorous story, but the joke's on me, and in the end, everything comes out all right on both sides, so I don't mind telling it. But it was I think it was in February of 1944, and we were the first P-51 unit assigned to the 8th Air Force. The 357th was. 354th was the first one over there with the B Mustangs, and they were the 9th Air Force, and they were supposed to cover the invasion. Well, they were so wildly successful that the 8th Air Force demanded Mustangs, and so our unit was next. So we get into combat, we got over there in November and probably got going early February. And we were starting to get victories already. And I'm a flight leader. I've been flight leader from day one.
How old were you?
22. I'm kind of wondering about my ability. Am I cut out for this? You know, when the time comes, am I going to fight or run? And I had chased a couple, but we had the rule in those days of run by the 8th Air Force bomber pilots that were running it, just to not pursue the enemy. You know, they wanted us to fly formation with them and just drive them away. You could go to 18,000 feet, then you break away and come back. So this one mission, I believe it was the second Berlin mission, we were on our way home, and I had a flight of three guys, and there was two other guys tacked onto us, and we're on our way home. And we see, I see two B-17 out ahead of us, straggler, smoking engines, he's flying slow, and they're down a little low. I headed over that way. And just as we got there, I'm a flight leader, I call it out, and then I'm gonna get the three ME-109s came after the B-17s. They were bellied up, they obviously didn't see us, and they're going after the straggler. We pull in right behind them, and they saw us right away, and this one ME-109, and I got into this circling maneuvers. Well, I couldn't get right on his tail, and our circles weren't good. He was coming at me at a very high angle, and I was coming at him at a very high angle, and you're putting so much G on the airplane that you couldn't, you just couldn't get there. I wanted to get right on his tail, but I couldn't. And it was down low. I wished he had the slats. Maybe he would have popped out. So I'm getting desperate, you know. I said, by God, I'm going to get this guy if I can. And when he came around like that, and he's pulling as hard as he can, and I'm pulling as hard as I can, I said, I'm just going to pull up ahead of him, aim ahead of him, fire a burst, and hope that he flew through the train of bullets. And so he comes around again, and we're working away, and I smoothly pulled it through, fired a big burst like that. He comes shooting out like that, and he's streaming coolant. And I said, all right, I got him, you know. And he pulled up immediately and bailed out. That's why I say it came out right for everybody. And I'm sitting there cheering, and I rolled out, and I looked over my wing, and here's another Mustang right on my wing. And it was Johnny England, the guy from England Air Force Base. That was who it was, the guy that the base was named for. He was from another squadron. He had a couple of kills already. And he pulled up there. We were down low. He had his mask off, and he's looking at me, and he's grinning. And he kind of goes like that. And I looked at him, I thought, you know, did he shoot that thing out from under me? You know? I knew it was a lucky shot if I had gotten him. And I still had another 2 hours to fly home. By the time I got home, I'd convinced myself that I probably hadn't shot that guy down, and it maybe was Johnny England. Kind of pissed me off a little bit, you know. But I, you know, there's a war going on. I guess that I didn't think of it very sportsmanlike, you know. There's a war going on, so I guess it's okay. I went on home, got my flight together, and I said, "Hey, did you see John England underneath me? Did he shoot that thing down?" And the guy says, "Hey, I was over here in a different position. I didn't really see it. I don't know." So we went in the intelligence briefings, and I claimed one victory, but I told him to hold it. I've got to talk to this guy. I got to talk to another guy. So I ran over to the club after that, and and then I'm on the way over. I said, how am I going to bring this subject up? You know, what the hell am I going to say? You know, hey, you jerk, did you shoot the thing out of me? I said, oh, man. I walked in the club, and he's right there at the bar. He sees me right away, and he comes running at me. He says, Andy, says that was the best shot I've ever seen. You got that sucker out there at 60 degrees angle off. And I said, oh, Johnny, you know, lucky shot. And I rushed to the phone and claimed my first victory.